The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It's worth noting that the president's instincts on alliances really aren't just a collection of policy views, but a part of a broader worldview that he has apparently had for several decades that's deeply antagonistic towards allies and a foreign policy reliant on alliances in a very broad sense. If we look back to 1987, we can find evidence of President Trump having taken out 3 full-page newspaper ads in which he lambasted our Japanese allies for underspending on defense. But what we have here is really more than a desire to get serious with allies about their defense spending, as so many of his other predecessors have already done. It seems that in our current case, what we're really looking at is a president with a willingness, maybe even a desire, to break our alliances over these cost-sharing issues. But it just bears noting that shaking down allies for defense dollars at the expense of alliances themselves is the ultimate self-defeating move. U.S. foreign policy will ultimately be far more expensive without alliances than with them. So my chief concern is that under the guise of a cost-saving mission, we're actually barreling towards strategic self-defeat at a moment when we can least afford to lose this tool of statecraft.
I'm Matt Waxman, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 19th, 2020. Dr. Mira Rapp Hooper is Schwartzman Senior Fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, Shields of the Republic, The Triumph and Peril of America's Alliances. I spoke with Mira about the history and strategic importance of American alliances, some of the constitutional issues alliances raise, and what the United States should do to revitalize its alliances going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 19th, Mira Rapp Hooper on Shields of the Republic. Congratulations, Mira, on a really terrific book. It's filled with smart insights, and I learned a lot from it. The title of your book is Shields of the Republic, The Triumph and Peril of America's Alliances. Why don't you start by breaking that down for us? What are the shields here?
Absolutely. Well, I'll really start, Matt, by saying it's a real pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thanks for your kind words about the book. But I wish all book rollouts could involve smart conversations with friends. So I've really been looking forward to this. When it comes to my title, what are the shields? Shield of the Republic is a reference to a 1943 book by Walter Lippmann, the mid-century journalist and commentator. He wrote at the height of World War II a book called U.S. Foreign Policy, Shields of the Republic. And there were two aspects of his argument which I felt really helped to explain how alliances have so served the interests of the United States. The first is Lippmann's insight that foreign policy serves first and foremost to protect the country, to keep it safe and prosperous. Alliances have done that for the United States to great effect, often in ways that we have not recognized. Second, Lippmann argues that foreign policy has to be strategically solvent. That is, foreign policy ends have to fit the means at its disposal. And the United States has been able to maintain a rather ambitious foreign policy since the end of World War II and do so cost effectively because its strategy ran through its system of alliances. But I added a F to Lippmann's subtitle, that is Shields of the Republic, plural, because the United States has updated its approach to alliances several times throughout the life of the Republic. And as I argue in the book, it will need to do so again to keep the system alive.
And turning then to the subtitle, which is The Triumph and Peril of America's Alliances, what are the triumph and the peril that you have in mind?
Well, the triumphs really relate to the fact that the system has been remarkably successful on the terms that early Cold War strategists set out for it. The Cold War obviously stayed cold, but significantly, no U.S. ally was ever the victim of an attack, which was, of course, exactly what the system was designed to prevent, and a fact that would have stunned Cold War strategists if you told them it would be true several decades later. On top of that, hot spots that seemed all too likely to escalate during the Cold War did not. I'm thinking there of divided Germany or the frozen conflict on the Korean Peninsula or in the Taiwan Straits. We certainly wouldn't have expected war everywhere, but those were places where it seemed all too likely. Crises that seemed likely to escalate remained manageable. The world saw far fewer nuclear weapon states as a result of the system. And more broadly, the United States built itself a tremendous reservoir of political goodwill that allowed it to sustain a very ambitious and enterprising foreign policy much more cheaply and easily than ever could have been possible otherwise. The perils, on the other hand, come in spite of these successes, and in some ways because of them. And that is the fact that the system has lasted long enough for geopolitics to change entirely in ways that now threaten its collapse. America's alliances were preserved after the Cold War, but with no clear rivals in view in Europe or in Asia, they weren't primarily focused on Russia or China anymore. And this created vulnerabilities that these rivals would later exploit. Rivals, again, namely Russia and China, have updated their post-Cold War strategies to account for the role of America's alliances, but the system itself has not yet moved to meet them. Of course, now the architect of the system, the United States, has turned on its own creation. So between these geopolitical forces and politics in the United States, the system is now really on the ropes.
Got it. So, in your telling, the modern post-war alliance system was something of a historical anomaly or a novelty. For the first two-thirds or so of American history, it was standard dogma to avoid entangling alliances because they might drag us needlessly into wars. Whereas after World War II, that dogma is completely inverted. The United States commits itself to alliances on the ground that they're now necessary to keep us out of wars. And that inversion from avoiding entangling alliances to embracing them actually brought about a standoff or a conflict between the executive and Congress that nearly derailed this effort to construct alliances. Tell us about those constitutional disputes.
Absolutely. So, Matt, the shift that you were talking about was really a shift in the way that the United States defined its own self-defense. That's how we explain why it went from abjuring alliances to embracing them so energetically. For the first 150 years of the Republic and sort of on the recommendation of George Washington in his farewell address, the United States absolutely took pains to avoid forming standing alliances with any country. So much so that Woodrow Wilson had to create a whole new category to avoid forming an alliance as the United States joined World War I. But after World War II, the United States' definition of national security and its requirements radically changed. In particular, because of radical changes in military technology, that is the advent of long-range air power, the advent of the missile age, and of course, nuclear weapons, the United States could no longer be safe behind its relatively favorable geography, behind two oceans and with its two relatively friendly neighbors. So it adopted a completely novel strategy. Countries had long used alliances to try to fight and win specific wars, but the gamble that Washington took was to form alliances to keep wars from starting at all. It sought to use them to hold the balance of power in Europe and Asia, and did so to try to deter and defend against the Soviet Union, as well as to assure its allies. Now, the first part of this experiment, the first mutual defense treaty in the system, was the Atlantic Alliance, which the Truman administration decided to negotiate after a request from a group of countries in Western Europe. And those European countries were seeking a pledge that if they became the victim of attack, the United States would rush to their aid. So they proposed a draft of this early treaty that contained the phrase forthwith military action. That is, if any one of them was attacked, the United States would immediately take up military action in their defense. The trouble was, of course, that if the United States had codified this in treaty language, it would have actually been making an advanced military commitment, pre-delegating Congress's power to declare war. And the administration, the Truman administration, was drafting this treaty language as it transitioned between secretaries of state. George Marshall was transitioning out, Dean Acheson was coming in. And the sensitivity of this congressional issue may not have been front of mind. So this draft treaty language actually made it all the way to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which was absolutely incensed and almost sunk the entire Atlantic Alliance effort. NATO's all-important Article 5 language had to be quickly reworded and instead was drafted to read that an attack on one member would be considered an attack on all, with each country committing to the actions it deemed necessary, but not necessarily to the use of military force. Now, later in treaties that the United States formed in Asia, it would also emphasize the importance of constitutional processes in meeting these commitments. So these large looming constitutional questions, that was how does the United States make a treaty commitment without pre-delegating a power reserved to Congress, was dealt with by crafting treaty guarantees that really don't guarantee any action in particular at all.
And in practice, how does this compromise work out? I mean, were these vague commitments and the, quote, constitutional processes language enough to do the trick, both for satisfying domestic political purposes and also for the foreign policy purposes? That seems like a pretty tough needle to thread here.
Yeah, it was an incredibly tough needle to thread. And somehow this bizarre compromise worked remarkably well, despite the fact that it seems sort of two-faced, right? What we're talking about here is really a set of treaty guarantees that don't guarantee all that much. So how could they satisfy all of these constituencies? The draft treaty language certainly got a ton of scrutiny before the Atlantic Alliance was ratified. But in some ways, once Congress got comfortable with the idea that the United States had found a way to square this circle, subsequent treaties were much easier to push through Congress, and the questions were scrutinized much less closely going forward. Moreover, it appeared to really satisfy both international constituencies, that is, be enough of a treaty commitment to deter adversaries, sending the signal to rivals like the Soviet Union, who might have contemplated attacking, that they could very well face retaliation from the United States if they did so, but not so specific that it required the United States to take any particular action. It joined its allies in crises on several occasions, however, but it had a lot of options when it did so, relatively few hard and fast obligations. But it also satisfied the third constituency, that is to say, the allies themselves. They seemed to feel that they had enough of a treaty commitment from the United States, particularly once the United States further backed up those treaty commitments in places with things like forward deployed troop presences, and in the case of NATO, an integrated military command, that they were satisfied that the United States actually had an incentive to make good on this very oblique commitment. That said, there has never been a direct attack on an American ally, so it's hard to say for certain how exactly this vague language worked, but it seems like the opaque, oblique nature of these treaty commitments has actually been pretty effective for the United States in satisfying all of these constituencies.
Yeah, you know, your last points bring us back to something that you alluded to earlier. That is that when alliances are working, we don't really see them at all. It's hard to measure success. So explain how you get around that in order to tell your story.
Yeah, it's an important question that motivates a lot of my book project, Matt. Alliances are one of a few different phenomena in international politics that are really vexing to measure because they bury their own record. Alliances are intended to deter conflict from breaking out at all, right? So the best alliance record is a record of non-events, a world in which wars don't break out and crises don't escalate. So how can we really examine the record of a system like this? The way I try to get at this problem in the book is through the use of counterfactuals, which are really a form of thought experiment. In each chapter of the book, I try to determine what work alliances did in a given era or on a given problem by holding constant a picture of the world and simply removing alliances from it so we can get a better sense of what work they might have been doing and what might have changed absent their presence. I think this is a useful exercise analytically because otherwise the alliance system is sort of, you know, burying its own history as mentioned, but and counterfactuals can help us to unearth it. But this also matters for policy. We can't really make sound decisions about future strategy and the extent to which we should or should not continue to rely on alliances unless we know where alliances seem to work and how. So to my mind, the counterfactual thought experiment was the best way to get at this problem.
Got it. And so despite these difficulties in measuring success, a pretty good case can be made for Cold War triumph. But you're not so optimistic about what's happened since the end of the Cold War. Why is that?
Well, as I noted a little earlier in the conversation, Matt, a lot of this alliance trouble is an outgrowth of the early success of the system. That is that America's alliances in both Europe and Asia were preserved after the Cold War, but without an eye to other great powers or defensive and deterrent missions, which had really been their sort of core competencies for decades. And that's because there weren't any other great powers to deter or defend against in Europe or Asia. But as a result of this radical change in geopolitical circumstance, and the fact that the United States decided to enlarge NATO, NATO then landed on Russia's doorstep through that process of enlargement. U.S. alliances in Northeast Asia were mostly focused on North Korea, as well as some issues surrounding trade and basing, whereas alliances in Southeast Asia really became a soft underbelly and kind of languished over the course of the 1990s. But over that same period, Moscow and Beijing were a little bit craftier in the way they thought about America's alliances. And over the course of the last couple of decades, they both really devised strategies that seek to upend alliances altogether, albeit in very different ways. At this point in time, both Russia and China have military strategies that aim to demonstrate that the United States can't defend its allies. I'm thinking of Russia's ability to show it can take territory on NATO's eastern flank, which emphasizes the difficulty in defending the Baltic states. And I'm also thinking of China's use of anti-access area denial approaches, which raise the risk to the United States of entering any conflict on behalf of an ally in the Western Pacific. But on top of these high-end military strategies, which are more or less the types of things that alliances were aimed at initially, both Moscow and Beijing have also developed coercive strategies that route around alliances without triggering them at all. I'm thinking there of things like Russia's election interference or China's maritime coercion inside of Asia. So through multiple routes, these rivals have really fixed alliances in their sights. And of course, the United States has only recently joined them, becoming something of an alliance antagonist from within. So that's the peril that we're talking about here, and why I think the alliance system is at a real moment of test in its history.
Got it. And then how does President Trump fit into that story of sort of where alliances are now and where they might be going?
Well, there's no question that President Trump is a significant exacerbant on these trends that were already underway. It's not uncommon to hear some analysts note that what President Trump really cares about with our allies seems to be burden sharing. And, you know, that is how much allies contribute to their own defense as part of a broader collective defense mission. And there's no question that many U.S. presidents throughout history have also been concerned about whether allies are doing enough. But I think that President Trump's obsession with allied burden sharing is really a difference in kind, not of degree. And it is so severe that it really does threaten to break this system entirely. It's worth noting that the president's instincts on alliances really aren't just a collection of policy views, but a part of a broader worldview that he has apparently had for several decades that's deeply antagonistic towards allies and a foreign policy reliant on alliances in a very broad sense. If we look back to 1987, we can find evidence of President Trump having taken out 3 full-page newspaper ads in which he lambasted our Japanese allies for underspending on defense. But what we have here is really more than a desire to get serious with allies about their defense spending, as so many of his other predecessors have already done. It seems that in our current case, what we're really looking at is a president with a willingness, maybe even a desire, to break our alliances over these cost-sharing issues. And I know we'll get into this later in the conversation, but it just bears noting that shaking down allies for defense dollars at the expense of alliances themselves is the ultimate self-defeating move. U.S. foreign policy will ultimately be far more expensive without alliances than with that. So my chief concern is that under the guise of a cost-saving mission, we're actually barreling towards strategic self-defeat at a moment when we can least afford to lose this tool of statecraft.
Now, you yourself have a pretty ambitious kind of renovation agenda in mind for alliances, that, you know, in order to save alliances, some things need to be done to them. Can you lay out a bit what you see as an agenda for rejuvenating them?
Absolutely. So as we've been discussing, you know, a central set of challenges come from the fact that American rivals have adopted new geopolitical strategies to advance their aims. And really, the nature of conflict and competition in the 21st century has changed in part because of the success of these pacts. That is, the understanding that they successfully deterred and helped to defend against conventional and military conflict. So as a result, the pacts themselves are going to have to change to meet this new landscape. Now, as it did in the early days of the Cold War, I think the United States still needs a strategy that some way or another seeks to uphold the global balance of power, particularly because China will continue to rise. But because so many threats on the horizon are non-military, the United States really needs to expand its alliances to non-military domains. In a few places, the United States and its allies might actually consider expanding what their treaty commitments cover to bring deterrence to new areas. I'm thinking there of things like cyber attacks on critical infrastructure or massive state-backed election interference campaigns, assaults that are so grievously damaging to a country's political independence and so grave to the allies who suffer them that we maybe should consider including them in our Article 5 mutual security guarantees. But beyond this very discrete set of activities, I think alliances can also be used to prepare for a far broader range of threats for which we really haven't used them to this date. Using them to coordinate around the national security implications of China's use of 5G technology, or to improve our global health preparedness and supply chain security in case we should face another pandemic. And as I see it, this broader conception of alliances really gives allies the opportunity to do a lot more. Allies in Europe and Asia could increasingly work with one another under a framework like this, specializing according to their relative comparative advantages. A country like Estonia, for example, really excels in cyberspace, whereas American allies in Asia have risen to the occasion on coming up with alternatives to China's Belt and Road Initiative. And one of the great benefits to expanding what our alliances cover is that our allies can actually contribute more financially as well. A broader set of alliances would draw much more heavily on contributions from foreign ministries or intelligence services, rather than requiring our allies to raise their defense budgets, which is often so hard for them to do from a domestic political perspective. So by improving the breadth of these alliances, I think we can also improve their balance and hopefully give them a chance to be far more functional in the decades ahead.
And just to clarify, when you're talking about expanding the breadth of alliances, are you talking here about actually changing the treaties themselves or leaving the treaties in place as fixed, but just making some policy changes in how they're implemented?
So it's a great question, Matt. And the answer is that the treaties will certainly remain fixed as they are. But in a couple of discrete cases, the United States and its allies should seriously consider formally applying the mutual defense clauses of those treaties to a wider set of activities. And that's what I'm thinking in cases like cyber attacks on critical infrastructure or state-backed election interference campaigns. I'm thinking that very usefully, the United States and its allies could try to deter these activities by formally stating that the Article 5 commitments cover these types of attacks, which would not only allow them to work together, but to try to prevent them from occurring in the first place. But for the most part, what I'm suggesting is really policy changes that seek to use alliances for a far broader range of activities that don't just fall in the high-end military domain or around areas like nuclear deterrence. That is, using them to create coordinating mechanisms around issues of new technology, even global health preparedness, and certainly other aspects of responding to and managing China's rise in Asia. So as I see it, the treaties actually remain quite sound. What they're suggesting is that we need collective defense and deterrence based in international law to try to hold a favorable balance of power and to pool resources. And I think that's exactly the mandate we see here in the 21st century. We just see it with respect to a broader charge of activities and domains than we saw in the early Cold War.
A year ago, you and I co-authored an article titled Presidential Alliance Powers, and I want to get your take on how some recent events relate to that piece and how they tie into your book. So in that article, you and I argued that since the advent of American alliances in the early Cold War, the president has had vast power, vast discretion to manage them. And some of that vast presidential power is constitutional as commander-in-chief, and some of it is delegated by Congress. And for most of the history of American alliances, those vast presidential powers have been seen as important to keeping alliances strong and credible. But now we're seeing Trump's action, President Trump's action, really in reverse. Those same powers to manage alliances can be used to weaken them from within. So talk about that a bit, and in particular, how are we seeing that play out in South Korea and in Germany in particular?
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. I was hoping that we'd get into this because I've been wanting to catch up with you on so many of these developments, particularly on South Korea and on Germany. So exactly as you just hashed out, you know, what we found is the fact that, of course, once a treaty guarantee, a defense treaty is ratified by the Senate, there's relatively little oversight power that Congress has and relatively few tools it can use to manage alliances or to manage the president if he happens to be managing alliances in an adverse way. And this is a product of decades of sort of accumulated power, exactly as you laid out. But because of some of the instincts I just identified with respect to President Trump in particular, his longstanding antagonism for the U.S. alliance system and desire to draw down troops, we're now really about to seemingly confront some of these congressional versus presidential powers issues head on. The president recently announced, if we can call it an announcement, it blindsided the Pentagon, our German allies, and our ambassador to NATO, a desire to withdraw 10,000 troops that are currently based in Germany to bring the number down to 25,000. Now, of course, the United States has drawn down troops from allied countries and elsewhere over the course of the history and can do this very rationally as the security circumstances dictate, often working with allies to assure them that their security is not actually in jeopardy. But in this case, the intent appears to be the opposite. Reporting would suggest that the president is seeking to punish Angela Merkel for not being willing to attend a G7 meeting in the United States. And because of a long-standing thorn that Germany does not yet spend 2% of its GDP on defense. But of course, the U.S. troop presence in Germany is not there primarily as philanthropy to Germany, but because the United States has defined its own national security as requiring a substantial troop presence in Europe. So it seems that this is actually a fairly punitive effort to radically change or significantly change the U.S. security posture in Europe for the sake of punishing Merkel. Over in South Korea, we see a similar set of dynamics potentially brewing. The U.S. and its ally in Seoul have been in a burden-sharing standoff for the last many months after the administration asked Seoul to quintuple its spending towards the alliance, despite the fact that it's already one of the cheapest places on earth to base American troops. And thus far, there has been no resolution to this standoff, despite the fact that Seoul has been willing to pony up quite a bit more by way of contributions. And the president has several times threatened to draw down troops in South Korea, despite the fact that the timing really couldn't be worse as North Korea gets more dangerous by the day. So what we're really seeing here is what appears to be a set of standoffs over whether or not the United States is actually going to keep up its force posture in both Germany and South Korea, which will very likely test what Congress can do about it. Matt, as we sort of started to talk about before we jumped on the line today, there are some early signs that in particular Democrats in Congress are going to try to throw up some hurdles in the president's way in the form of legislation that would make it harder for him to draw down. But I'd love to get your take on how feasible that's likely to be, given the history that we've seen in the relative balance of presidential versus congressional alliance management power.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting issue to end on, because there are legal and policy issues here, but also some important issues of where is the American public on alliances? Because I think, and you and I talked about this in our Presidential Alliance Powers article, Congress does have some tools available to try to limit the president's ability to weaken alliances from within. I mean, among them, things like, you know, trying to prohibit or at least make it more difficult for the president to withdraw troops from alliances. These are powers that I think Congress has, but these are not ones that it is at all well practiced in using. And it's not just formal powers that can be enacted through legislation, but also informal political powers, using the platform that members of Congress have as committee chairs or as blocks of legislators to try to raise the political cost to the president in weakening alliances. I think Congress does have options here. Some of them will be legally controversial. Some of them will be politically difficult. It does have options. To me, a big question is, does it have the political will? And this is really where I'd like to end our conversation, is coming back to you on, you know, where is the American public on this? It's hard for me to believe that Congress is really going to push back hard against presidential efforts to weaken alliances, unless there's a real political incentive for it to do so. So where is public opinion on alliances these days? And does Congress have much political incentive to fight the president on this kind of issue?
Yeah, it's another great question. Before I jump into it, I'll just mention something that we talked about before, which are some of these historical examples and what they tell us about what the specific options are that Congress might have if it seeks to sort of throw up roadblocks to President Trump's attempts to draw down. Specifically, a case that you and I have pored over together was Jimmy Carter's efforts to draw down U.S. troops from South Korea in the late 1970s, which he was pretty determined to do. But at the time, a consortium of folks from the Pentagon, the intelligence community, and Congress really got together and ultimately made it clear to Carter that they thought the danger from North Korea was far greater than what he was stating, and that they intended to make his life really hard if he tried to push ahead with this troop withdrawal. Now, the fact that the Germany announcement blindsided the Pentagon might suggest to us that some kind of consortium along these lines could be possible if Congress wants to throw up roadblocks here too. That is to say, there's presumably a lot of folks at the Pentagon who are concerned about this announcement, perhaps folks in the intelligence community. So if Congress does in particular want to use its appropriations powers to refuse to give funds to troop relocation, for example, it may find that it has allies inside the bureaucracy who are looking to do something similar. But on the question of public opinion, I think this is an important issue to end on, exactly as you say, because American public opinion is actually quite in favor of alliances, perhaps more so even than it has been in the past. Recent polling shows that Republicans, independents, and Democrats all generally see alliances quite favorably and are very much in favor of the United States relying on the use of alliances for its foreign policy. There's an instinctive understanding in public opinion that alliances generally mean the United States is probably spending less and is probably a lot less likely to use military force unilaterally if it's working with allies. The one exception to this appears to be that increasingly folks who self-identify as being in President Trump's core base of supporters are negative on NATO, but that's probably a reflection of partisanship as opposed to a deeply held view of the alliance itself. But that public support, you know, leads us back to the question of then why we are so worried. That is to say, if we think Congress may have options, if we think there may still be some amount of bipartisan support for alliances, then why are we so concerned that this system could be broken by virtue of the sort of capriciousness of one man? And I think that takes us back to the point that we made in our article. That is the fact that there is just extraordinary power vested in this chief executive and any chief executive when it comes to this system. So even if President Trump is not elected in November, I think part of the charge when it comes to renovating America's alliance system for the future is figuring out how to make it more resilient to the vicissitudes of another politician. That is to say, these presidential powers will remain heavily accumulated no matter who the chief executive is. And we're seeing what the dangers of that can be. We've talked about one historical case, that is the case of the U.S. withdrawal from its alliance with Taiwan, in which Congress tried to stop President Carter from ending an alliance in favor of recognizing China. And despite suing Carter and taking the case all the way to the Supreme Court, Barry Goldwater could not put up roadblocks to that presidential withdrawal. So even though we've got public opinion on the side of a collective defense strategy going forward, and a lot of folks in Congress who seem willing to stick their necks out, we certainly should not convince ourselves that this tool is by any means safe. And quite to the contrary, we've got a lot of reason to believe that it could see a very bumpy road ahead, no matter who the leadership is.
Well, that's a great issue to end on. I want to say again, Mira, congratulations on a terrific book. It's also a really important book. So thanks very much for coming on and talking to me about it.
Such a pleasure, Matt. Great to be here with you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank, and the podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and share it widely. And as always, thanks for listening.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money.